And we had a lot of translated fiction, which we kept in, you know, in the country of origin places. They don't keep them, amalgamate them now, but Archie was very keen on European fiction. And it was surprising how much you got. We were really extraordinarily lucky. I think we only had about two shipments that actually didn't reach us on the ships, because books were scarce and the paper was terrible.
Yes.
So they didn't last very long. But you could. There was a great boon about American, because it still came on beautiful paper and wonderful bindings. But of course, there were all the copyright laws that precluded. We weren't supposed to be buying half the stuff we bought from America because it was supposed to come from Britain. We would buy American editions and be blowed because sometimes they just didn't get round to publishing them in Britain. There's always been a tussle between libraries and these sort of dividing the world into two hemispheres.
Do you think that made a dent really in the British influence?
I think it probably did. Yeah, I think it probably did. We had a lot of, and of course, a lot of our librarians in the major libraries went on Carnegie fellowships to the United States and got imbued with American administrative thing. And that's what changed Dunedin Public Library around from being very trad British under McEwan, though he had a brilliant book buying, but suddenly there was this ginger that came into it, and it sort of actually... He was sort of given to throwing things in here and then sorting them. Well, he sort of virtually threw the whole library in the air. Because I remember when I took over the commercial and technical section, it was just terrible. The place was, books shelves were stuffed, and there were technical dictionaries from 1901, and this was 1946. And I was standing looking at this thinking, and he had a knack of coming up when you were looking your most goofy and saying, "You're finding it terrible." And I said, "Well, yes, something has to be done with this, doesn't it?" And he said, "Let's do it." And for a month, we went round with a big trolley, going through every book on the shelves and putting into the basement the ones that were dead and gone. But all the time he was talking about the principles of how you bought books. It was better than any library school.
And yes, this librarian, when did he come to work in Dunedin?
He came to work in 1934, and he stayed until 1960 when he went on to off to organise libraries for UNESCO in Indonesia.
It was obviously an influence on you.
Oh, absolutely, my guru. I have no doubts about it at all, absolutely. And I got to know him again very well when I was working in Auckland Public Library, and he was living retired up in Morpeth, and Peter and I would go up and spend weekends with him, and it was just great. He just hadn't lost any of the ginger. And just before he died, at the age of not quite 90, Peter had died, and Jim and I, my brother and I, were in Northland, and I said, "I want to see Archie." So we went to see him, and I was talking about the amalgamations, and I said that the new library had just gone up in Waikawaiti, and that Dunedin ran it now, and he looked at me and said, "Just what we always wanted, my dear." And that was about the last thing he said. But he was just, he was an inspiration, but he, of course, he drove people nuts that didn't like change. And he was always thinking about change. I was grizzling about the gardening section, which was all classified at 635.9, and there were about 500 books in it or more. And the previous librarian of that department had bound all the gardening books in green. And I was looking at this again, being disgusted. And he came up, as usual, he came along and said, "You don't like it, do you?" And I said, "Well, no, I don't." And he said, "Let's throw them all on the floor and rearrange them." And that's precisely what he did.
Well, that is interesting, because you don't associate a love of change with librarians. Librarians have a different
stereotype, don't they? It's not true. The minute computers came in, we were actually putting stuff into a computer on 80-column punch cards. Now, putting bibliographic data into 80-column punch cards was not easy, but we did it because we thought that was the way to the future. And then, of course, miniaturisation came in, and you can do anything. But you couldn't then. But we were into it. We had our first serials list published, I think, in 1970, when it was still 80-column punch cards to enter into a computer. And yet, it annoyed me, because people do say they think that we're, you know, stuck in the past. Whereas we've seized on computers completely.
So there is an image of, of librarians as being stayed.
Stayed, yes, and have glasses and long hair.
What was your favourite, if you did have one anyway, your favourite author as a young woman then when you first started working in libraries?
I've a feeling that, you know, amongst my favourites were people like Graham Greene and Evelyn Waugh.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember. Oh, Ernest Hemingway, mm-hmm. I was a bit fascinated by, but mm-hmm. also a bit repelled. But there were other people mm-hmm. too. Travel authors, some of them. I remember my mother reading H.V. Morton all the time. Mm-hmm. I started off by taking In Search of Scotland to her, but she read all of his mm-hmm. things after that, and I probably read some of them, but not mm-hmm. all of them. Mm-hmm. But there were some travel authors that I liked.
Mm-hmm.
And detective novels, Dorothy Sayers and, you know, they were... Margie Allingham.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we were seeing all these coming in news, so you just, you know, you had the pick of the world, really.
Mm-hmm.
Not working in a library makes it more difficult. You've got to put them on reserve, and actually...
I don't suppose you'd have any need to buy books, then.
Well, theoretically, no. But I always wanted to own them, and particularly I've got quite a big New Zealand collection. Mm-hmm. Not the fiction, I've reduced quite a bit. That's the fiction over there.
There are two large bookshelves and a small bookshelf in here, and then another small library in the opposite.
That's all
reference.
That's all reference stuff, and part of
that. Dictionaries and
yes, well, part of that was because I taught reference work in the library mm-hmm. school in Monash, and some of those came from that. But there are other things there, because Dunedin has written itself up a lot, and there's a very nice biographical thing called Southern People. Have you mm-hmm. seen that?
I have, yes.
Yes, well, I've got a copy of mm-hmm. that there. Mm-hmm. I actually did some things for it, so they gave it to me.
Mm-hmm.
But theoretically, I'm reducing the fiction, but I'm reducing everything,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't happen.
No, so you must have... And some of these books you may have had for a long time.
Oh, a lot of those I've had for a very long time. Some of them would have been Peter's, but not very many, but probably the collections of Graham mm-hmm. Greene were Peter's.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of them were mine. Mm-hmm. There's probably almost a complete selection mm-hmm. of Aunt Margie Allingham there. Mm-hmm. There's also almost a complete section of Georgette Heyer.
Really?
Yes.
Now, when did you start reading Georgette Heyer?
Oh, almost the minute she started mm-hmm. coming out. I think she's an interesting phenomenon because she's still in print.
She is, yes.
And she started writing about 1920s mm-hmm. and 30s.
She did.
I've got a number of friends who are very literary, mm-hmm. but they've got a collection of Georgette Heyer.
Well, you know, Georgette Heyer's been kind of reappraised.
Is that right?
Yes, she has.
Well,
and I must tell you, I read Georgette Heyer too.
Yes.
In the Carnegie Public Library in
Ayr. Right, in Ayr. Well, there you are.
And I think she is, for a lot of young women, an entree into more serious fiction.
And I don't think it's just women. Mm-hmm. My brother had a complete set of Georgette Heyer
did
too.
He?
Yes, he did. And if he got bored with things, mm-hmm. he just liked her sort of descriptions of the period, and of course he was always interested in the Napoleonic Wars, and because her Spanish Bride is really quite you know, seriously historical novel, and the infamous army, and I think that's where he started going into them, and then he found them quite amusing, and funnily enough, he hadn't read Jane Austen until the BBC began to do the television ones, and I got him, he didn't have television, but he'd come up here and watch. So he bought a complete Jane Austen, and he read that cover to cover.
Right, so was this the BBC ones that were done in the 60s?
Yes, later than that.
Pride and Prejudice in the
60s. It was the films he saw. A series that must have been...
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was after I come back to Dunedin, and I came back about 1996.
Mm-hmm.
So they must have been in the late 90s, and they did Sense and Sensibility and Pride and Prejudice.
Oh, yes,
the cinema.
And Emma. Uh-huh.
And I was away for a holiday, and Jim told me at the end of it, while I was away, he had gone 12 times to see Sense and Sensibility. He just thought it was all so beautiful.
Uh-huh.
And part of it was that, and of course he liked the language.
Uh-huh.
So Jane Austen was obviously somebody, well, I've got a complete set of Jane Austen somewhere in there.
Did you read Jane Austen at school?
Yes. But we didn't. I don't remember having to read it at school, which would probably have made me dislike it. The other person I've realised, of course, was John Buchan. That was in our house.
Mm-hmm.
I'd forgotten about him. But he was very, very mm-hmm. much part mm-hmm. Of the reading.
Yes.
And, you know, Mr. McCall Smith is now becoming a sort of addiction.
Now, and it's interesting you mention Alexander McCall yes. Smith, because I looked for his books in the library, the Dunedin Public
They're
Library.
They're always out. They've got the yes. lot.
I did wonder about that.
Yes.
Because
yes.
I thought, surely
yep.
they can't They've got not multiple, be here.
They've got multiple copies of them, uh-huh. actually.
Oh, but They're
lucky,
all out.
You're lucky if you find them in. Uh-huh. Yes.
Very popular.
Very popular.
Now, why do you think that is?
Don't know. It's the way he writes, partly. Mm-hmm. I think he actually writes in a very clear mm-hmm. way. But I think he also, mm-hmm. for anybody that knows Edinburgh, mm-hmm. he, you know, he really has got it. Mm-hmm. He's got it as a mm-hmm. sort of... It's interesting, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But he's got a huge following, and if I find one in on the shelves, it's lucky. Mm-hmm. And usually I have to put in a reserve for mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. So he's an addiction, I think, that people start. Mm-hmm. I'd like to hear him speak, because everybody says he's very good, an interesting speaker. Mm-hmm. Andrew Rankin came out. Andrew Rankin's another one that everybody likes. You know, his Edinburgh things, his Rebus
novels. Oh, the Rebus novels, yes.
And he came uh-huh. and he mm-hmm. spoke. And the library mm-hmm. hired the one of the little concert chamber place mm-hmm. and gave free admission to anybody that wanted to come and hear him speak.
Uh-huh.
And a local, I think it was a local radio mm-hmm. person, mm-hmm. interviewed him. Mm-hmm. And it was absolutely fascinating. I really enjoyed it because it gave you an idea of what he was up to. Mm-hmm. And what he's up to, of course, he's always trying to reform something. You know, something he sees in Edinburgh that needs fixed.
Yes. Uh-huh. Really? And did you enjoy that then, hearing
yes,
about that?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And that, I'd got, to be quite honest, I'd virtually stopped reading them because, you know, all these detective novels seem to me to be interesting for the first few, and then they've a formula,
mm-hmm.
and you can practically predict what's going to happen, mm-hmm. and you get tired mm-hmm. of the people. And I got tired of Rebus. Mm-hmm. But there were things about him that I thought was funny, because apparently the fetus, you know, the headquarters of the police uh-huh. got a new police dog, which uh-huh. they called Rebus. And he said, I do wish they'd called him Rankin. Which I thought was lovely. And the other thing that I felt was unique to Scotland mm-hmm. was one of his books came out, and I think it was the Chief Constable of Scotland mm-hmm. reviewed it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, can you imagine a Chief Constable of anywhere else reviewing a book on detective yes. novels? Because uh-huh. I can't. Mm-hmm. And it had a heading that said something like, time you came in for your medical, Rebus. Something like that. And I thought, now that is Scottish. That is a very Scottish thing, mm-hmm. that the Chief Constable would actually do a review.
Oh, and where did he... do this?
I think it was in the Scotsman.
Really?
Uh-huh. I think so. Uh-huh. It must have been in one of my wanderings. This must be a few years back. Uh-huh. I just thought that mm-hmm. I just couldn't envisage mm-hmm. anywhere else in the world that this would happen.
No. But I think actually the police quite like...
I think they love it.
Yeah, they do.
Yes, they do. Uh-huh. That's what I think is so interesting too, is that he's part of this mm-hmm. community. Mm-hmm. But he was very funny because he said Rebus had to retire. And he said, when you look at some of these other people that have been writing novels, Adam Dalgliesh must be 95.
Yes.
It's realist, real time. This was going. That is really, that was very entertaining. And the library actually organised that mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. had this session with him. Mm-hmm. So that.
Oh, he's far travelled then, isn't he?
Oh, yes.
Mr. Rankin.
Oh, yes. Yes, there are a lot of people that read him. I think mm-hmm. he's a high demand. Mm-hmm. And it's true of lots of people. There are now a lot of New Zealand novelists that are well-read here. Mm-hmm. But New Zealanders didn't take a lot of interest in their own literature probably until the last... or post-war, anyway. Mm-hmm. And then it developed in some very good way. Mm-hmm. You get people like Janet Frame, who's sort of world-famous.
Yes, I'll be honest with you, she was really the only person I had heard of.
Well, I think that's true. Yes. Mm-hmm. See, I've got favourites like Barbara Anderson, whom mm-hmm. I regard as very good. I don't know whether I've got any kicking around now. Probably not. Elizabeth Knox. It's another one.
I don't think
you'll have seen her, I think, abroad.
Mm-hmm. I've also seen, I think there was someone was shortlisted for the Booker Prize.
Yes. The one that won the Booker Prize was Kerry Hume, mm-hmm. the Bone People, mm-hmm. and Mr. Pip mm-hmm. was shortlisted. Yes. Now that's very good. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed Mr. Pip. Now that's a male author.
I'm trying to remember this one though, yes. Elizabeth Knox. That looks quite interesting.
Yes, it is. Uh-huh. That's a sort of almost autobiographical one, that mm-hmm. one. Mm-hmm. But she's written some good novels. Uh-huh. Barbara Anderson, mm-hmm. who's, I think, very good. She's one of the best. And she's just done her autobiography, but I haven't read it yet. Mm-hmm. But they're interesting. But Elizabeth Knox is one of the people. That's, I think I must have bought that. Mm-hmm. You see, why do I buy it? I should get it out of the library, shouldn't
I? Know, but if you love books, sometimes you want to have them.
You can't resist them. That's right. And a lot of the local history, I like to have that mm-hmm. because it's, you know, we're always poking in it. You know, mm-hmm. somebody will be talking around the table and you get a mm-hmm. question. And you find that I find myself over in that corner digging out the reference stuff or getting book uh-huh. from the shelves in there.
Well, that's interesting that you've shifted your historical interest to here.
Yes,
To your own locality.
I think I do that mm-hmm. much more. I've got, mm-hmm. and I've got a bit of Scottish history. Mm-hmm. I think the trouble with me about Scottish history is that we did a lot in Glasgow. Mm-hmm. I used to break my heart over it. Mm-hmm. I can remember at 8 going home to my mother and saying, I just wish one of those Stuart kings could have died in his bed. She thought this was the funniest thing, but it was my way of saying, you know, why were they always killed when they were so young or at war? And I just broke my heart over Scottish history, and I can't read about the clearances. Mm-hmm. I've begun to come more to terms with that recently because there's been such a lot of talk about the amount of emigration that came out after mm-hmm. the clearances. Mm-hmm. But it's a sad history, really. Mm-hmm. And I find it quite upsetting, so I think in a way I was probably quite pleased to mm-hmm. not read it. Always happy to read about literature and the philosophy and John, you know, all the sort of...
Do you think it's taught that way here, Mary, as a kind of tragic history?
No. I don't know that it's taught here at all.
No.
I don't think it's taught mm-hmm. here at all. Not separately from mm-hmm. British history. Mm-hmm. I would very much doubt it. Mm-hmm. I don't know enough about what this mm-hmm. curriculum looks like, but I think it's pretty unlikely that there's anything seriously.
It's one other aspect of sort of Britishness, and then I'll have a wee break for you, mm-hmm. like you've been talking a long time, and a genre of reading as well, and that's to do with royalty.
Yes.
How are they viewed, or how did you view the royal family, say, when you left? Scotland.
Well, I think Glasgow was always slightly disrespectful because I have this memory of December 1936, which mm-hmm. was not long before we left, and it was when Edward VIII abdicated, uh-huh. and all along Byers Road were students singing, "Hark the Herald Angels Sing, Mrs. Simpson's Pinched Our King." Yes. So there was a certain amount of disrespect. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. About it, but I think they became, everybody here became, mm-hmm. and I think everybody became mm-hmm. very attached to George VI. Mm-hmm. You know, they felt that he had not been brought up mm-hmm. to be king, and here mm-hmm. he was, the speech impediment and the shyness and all the rest of it, and great admiration for, you know, the Duchess of York mm-hmm. becoming queen and all the rest of it, and that feeling for royalty was intense here, and when the Queen and Prince Philip came out in 1953, which was the year after the coronation, the place went mad. Thousands turned out to see them. Now they can come and go from the country and nobody even notices. Mm-hmm. It has just altered utterly. Mm-hmm. But at that stage it was excitement, and here was this glamorous young lady, mm-hmm. and it was just...
Did you go to see the Queen anywhere?
Oh, and yes. Everybody did. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all... And there were stories about the pair of them and where they stayed, and mm-hmm. just nothing else mattered mm-hmm. for that whole time they were here. Mm-hmm. The next time they came back must have been quite a lot later, because Princess Anne and Prince Charles came with mm-hmm. them, And, you know, people turned out in mm-hmm. quite big numbers then, but there wasn't the same intensity of feeling as this young, glamorous queen. Mm-hmm. And, of course, added to it, of course, was the Ed Hillary story that he had climbed Everest just at the right moment, mm-hmm. you see. So he remained, of course, mm-hmm. and he still is mm-hmm. probably the great New Zealand hero. Mm-hmm. And it was all mixed up in this sort of royal coronation thing. Uh-huh. But that's gradually all faded away. And I don't think New Zealand is ready for a republic. Mm. The Australians were more or less ready. Mm. And what finished that off was that they couldn't decide how to elect a president. Mm. Mm-hmm. And that may, in fact, be the stumbling block for everybody mm. after watching the circus of American presidents.
Yes, indeed.
Uh-huh. Who wants to elect a president? Uh-huh.
And what about we still get them in Britain now, sort of magazines about royalty and quite glossy books on royalty.
They reckon that you put a photograph of a royal person on the front of a Women's Weekly and you sell it. Mm-hmm. That's the way
really?
To do it.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Here too.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. They've got books on the royal family in the library mm-hmm. and I'm sure that they go out, get worn out mm-hmm. quite regularly. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, it's still... And there's still a fascination with the two princes, you know, even though everybody thinks, you know, what the heck. They still want to know what their ladies are doing and whether they've broken up with whatever their names are. And
oh, they have.
They seem to have, don't they?
Yes.
Yes. And, you know, I just feel sorry for them because I think they've got a hopeless life. Mm. And I think that's now the way people are much more feeling about the royal family. I have a feeling in Scotland that the one person that they think is okay was mm-hmm. Princess Anne. Mm-hmm. You know,
yes.
they'd have her for queen. She's uh-huh. okay. She's out there working. She's not making a fuss.
Well, she supports the Scottish rugby team.
She goes, yes, and sings the Flower of Scotland in the middle of Murrayfield. But you get this sort of feeling that she's the right sort of person for Scotland too. Mm-hmm. It suits them. She's not... Not a glamour puss, and she clearly, the life is okay. And I was interested, not so much this time, but the previous time when I was in Edinburgh, I was seeing the Scotsman every day, and it had lists of what she was doing, and she was off in little places. She was going to small schools, and it wasn't big, flourishy stuff. Mm-hmm. She was doing these practicalities of being around, and everybody felt this was okay. Mm-hmm. I don't know what they find. I wonder if they got as excited about Princess Diana's death as everybody else. Mm-hmm. And George Square, Glasgow, was covered with flowers.
Mm-hmm. But how was it here?
I think I wasn't here.
Oh, you were.
It happened when I happened to be in Canada. Mm-hmm. And that was the oddest thing. Mm-hmm. I was out on an island in the middle of Howe Sound. Mm-hmm. And we hadn't heard a word. Mm-hmm. And Murray, my cousin's son, had been with his mate down in I think just listening to the radio, and they had heard about mm-hmm. Princess Diana being killed. And we were sitting having afternoon tea on this Sunday afternoon, and Murray suddenly said, oh, did you know that Lady Di has been killed? Quite casually. Mm-hmm. And we said, what, say that all over again? And he said, you know, Princess Diana, she was killed in Paris last night. Now, they had thought nothing much about it. Well, I left Vancouver that day, and I went off to stay with Oxford Friends of Peter's mm-hmm. in Montreal. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that they stopped looking at that television mm-hmm. all week. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, well, when I get to Glasgow, it won't be like this, it won't be like this. And there it was.
It was.
Flowers strewn everywhere. Mm-hmm. So it was a sort of worldwide hysteria, mm-hmm. wasn't it?
It was indeed. Yeah.
Extraordinary. Mm-hmm. The whole thing. And yet when it had started off with those mm-hmm. kids in Vancouver... Mm-hmm. They weren't feeling that at all. Mm-hmm.
Now that's interesting, isn't it? Maybe it's a generational thing.
Well, I wondered about that, but here she was, she'd been killed in a car accident. Uh-huh. And it was hours after, you know, it was afternoon and they'd heard it probably the night before. Mm-hmm. And that was it. Well, I wasn't here, of course, I didn't see what happened here, but I don't think it would be any different.
Yes.
Uh-huh. It would be wall to wall, Princess Diana. And this was American, often, stations that we were watching in Montreal. And it was just non-stop.
Yes, it was big news in the States, I think.
Yes, yes it was. And then there was all the criticism of the flags on Buckingham Palace and how they weren't there. All the stuff. They couldn't win, could they? Mm-hmm. It was awful. I think we should make lunch now, do you?
We shall give a wee... And we've had a wee break again, and I wanted to start back in, Mary, by asking you about going back to Scotland and how you felt about that the first time you went back.
Well, I found it very exciting, really, because I think I'd wanted to go for a long time, and of course all my contemporaries mm-hmm. had long gone mm-hmm. and done their OE, and I didn't really want to just sort of go and trip around. Mm-hmm. So I had written to Glasgow, to Glasgow Public Libraries, mm-hmm. said, was there any chance of a job? Mm-hmm. Well, they were very cautious. They said, mm-hmm. would I come in and see them? But when I went in to see them, they gave mm-hmm. me a job, and I spent the first month in the superintendent's division, uh-huh. which was run by a librarian called Miss French, mm-hmm. who was very good. She was just great. But after about a month of this, they said, how would I like to go to Castlemilk with this new branch that they were starting to get the books ready? Mm-hmm. So
and
I went out
what
there.
What year was this?
1960.
Right, so Castlemilk really was still being built.
It was brand new. Uh-huh, there wasn't uh-huh. a single public amenity mm-hmm. in the place. Mm-hmm. There were two policemen on scooter bikes who circled the place, uh-huh. and they would tell me wonderful stories mm-hmm. about all the best safe breakers in mm-hmm. Glasgow mm-hmm. lived in Castlemilk Road.
Now, Castlemilk Road's a big, long road.
It's a big, long road, yes, it's a big, long road. And we lived down Castlemilk Road, just a bit down, because it was easy mm-hmm. to get a bed and breakfast mm-hmm. over there. And they were the best. The houses were the most beautifully rigged out in Glasgow, because mm-hmm. with the money that they made from safe breaking, they relined them in oak and mahogany and all this. He said, but really they were innocents abroad, mm-hmm. because every time they came to a safe break, mm-hmm. there was a signature on it. They all had their own methods and they never changed them. Mm-hmm. So they'd go to visit them, and half the time the loot was still in the house. So we got to know a lot about sort of Glasgow life from them. Mm-hmm. But it was an interesting place because we had this whole stock, brand new stock mm-hmm. for the library. Mm-hmm. And the librarian, who was a Manchester man actually, had decided that it had the best furniture, mm-hmm. that this may have been a sort of slum clearance mm-hmm. area. But so we had Parker Knoll chairs mm-hmm. and mahogany bookshelves. Mm-hmm. And it was before the days of carpet on the floor, so we had linoleum, but mm-hmm. very attractive mm-hmm. cream with red and blue stripes. And it was an interesting place, underfloor heating with water pipes, mm-hmm. which meant, of course, when the heat went off in the late afternoon, it kept warm. Mm. The place was never cold.
Because it can be cold up there on top of that hill.
Well, you're a long way up mm-hmm. from well, King's Park was the nearest mm-hmm. centre. Mm-hmm. But there was not a shop in the area. No. There was something like 80,000 people there. Mm. And no pubs, no shops, nothing. And we were the first. Although eventually they opened the library, and the Lord Provost, who was a woman, arrived to open the library. Mm. And a lot of the Glasgow councillors came up. And we could hear this cheering up the road. Mm. And they reckoned that more people came out to see them coming up to open the library mm-hmm. than had come for the last royal tour. But what really interested me was that I expected them to be arriving mm-hmm. in their Rolls Royces, mm-hmm. not on your life. They arrived in Glasgow double-decker buses, which seemed to me to be nice Glasgow touch. Uh-huh. But after that, I handed the library over to the person who was going to carry it mm-hmm. on, and I went to the Central Stirling's Library, which was in the old Royal Exchange.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. We're the Museum of Modern Art is now. Yes, uh-huh. That was a lovely building, uh-huh. but boy, was it hard work. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody asked mm-hmm. you a question and you were at the front door, you ran mm-hmm. a half a block to get it mm-hmm. back. But Miss French, who'd been in charge of mm-hmm. the, was there as a librarian, mm-hmm. deeply resented by the men because mm-hmm. no woman had occupied a senior position up till then. Mm-hmm. But she didn't worry, mm-hmm. never worried her. So, a very happy time because mm-hmm. I'd never encountered a downtown branch where mm-hmm. all your work was concentrated mm-hmm. in the 2 hours of lunch hour mm-hmm. and immediately after work at night.
Yes, quite interesting aspect of
yes,
Glasgow libraries. That,
quite different mm-hmm. from the mm-hmm. really the branch libraries. Mm-hmm. The thing that interested me too was that Glasgow allowed free access to the libraries, not just for the people that lived in Glasgow, mm. but for the people that worked in Glasgow, mm-hmm. because they calculated that they contributed to the economy of mm-hmm. the city. Mm-hmm. So in fact, we were serving roughly a population of probably 1.75 million, not just the million that were actually in Glasgow City. And I always thought that was a really generous sort of proposition. And then for the last 2 weeks, they let me go into the Mitchell, which of course was male, completely male privileged dominated place. And that was interesting because it really was great. And they were just moving over from putting into classified order. They'd always had it so that it was an accession order, so the latest accessions were near the desk because they were asked for most. And they were changing over to have it in duly order, and the boys didn't like this very much.
Oh, change in libraries.
That's right, yes. Good enough.
How long were you out in Castle Milk for then?
I must have been about 3 months out there. At least that, perhaps 4, because we went up long before Christmas, because remember the going down in the bus at night after dark, of course, and all the Christmas trees in everybody's window, and it was lovely. So I think I was probably about 4 months in Castle Milk, and mostly not with the public, but I was there for about two weeks after it started, and then handed it over to the person that was taking charge of it.
Because I was going to ask you if you noticed anything different about people's reading tastes in Castle Milk, the likes of Castle Milk compared to, say,
no,
for example,
I don't think
in
I
Dunedin.
Did actually. There was a very condescending attitude with some people about Castle Milk, but the first inquiry I got was from a fellow who was a retired engineer, and he wanted Marcel Proust. So, you know, there they were wanting to read seriously, and the children, it was in a way, it was almost a disaster because the loans board had dictated the size of the library because of the same thing happened here, of course, money was scarce. And the children's library was far too small for the number of, and we simply had to limit the number that could be in at any one time. And the kids would queue up out there in practically snowy weather with their books in plastic bags because they were split numerous, you see. And, you know, there they were waiting for an hour out there in order to get in. And the books were just, you know, just flooded in and out. It could have been, it should have been at least 4 times the size of that children's library. I don't know whether anything's been enlarged since. It's probably not quite as children dominated now anyway, because there would be young families just moved in there.
I think what's happened now is that they've changed it internally, but I think it's still the same building.
Is that right?
And it's right on the main drive.
That's right, yes.
It's interesting what you say about it being the first amenity there.
Yes.
Isn't that interesting?
Isn't it?
Glasgow?
Yes. Yes. It was you know, the sort of great British love of fish and chips. There was a chap who brought a mobile fish and chippery up at lunchtime, and you know, half the staff went waltzing out to get their fish and chips. But they're very well set up. It was the first time I'd seen a library staff room that actually had a little cooker and facilities. We were used to most primitive conditions down in the basement of the old public library here. And while there was a kitchen, nothing could have called it modern. It had probably been installed in 1908 when the library opened. So there were certain aspects of it that were, but the whole thing was very entertaining because putting new stock in at the shelves and the other thing that I...
And did you get any say in selecting what the
No. The selection was all done. We were just simply handling the stuff and making sure it was catalogued and onto the shelves. I think what fascinated me most, I think, at the end was that every day the motor, it was always the motor came round once a day with cartons of books. And we'd go out, there'd be 6 of us, and we'd help the driver to move the stuff into the library. And then they would go away. And when I went round at the very end to say goodbye to the head man who ran all these delivery blocks, and I said to Mr. McAuliffe, you know, it's been great meeting your blocks, and they were great. And he said, well, I've got to tell you that no other librarian in this city ever carries a book from a vehicle to a library. Yeah. And I said, but we did it all the time. And he said, oh, we noticed. It just shows you what New Zealanders do. And then he looked at me and said, but you did have a good start. That was sort of my farewell to Glasgow Libraries. I loved it. I really had a great time there. I was going for 3 months and I stayed 7.5. Yeah.
So you went back with your mother, is that?
Yes,
that right?
Yes.
Before I go on, what's the OE, by the way, you mentioned?
Oh, overseas experience.
Right.
Yes, that's what they all call it now.
Right, and you wanted to have that, did you?
Well, no, I just wanted to go home. Nobody talked about that then, but almost all my friends went off and had a year or two in Britain. Mm-hmm. And in those days, there were no limitations, of course. You could go and you could stay as long as you liked because all the rules hadn't come in. Mm-hmm. They came in probably about 1960, 61. Things began to get tougher. Mm-hmm. I didn't ever have a problem because I could have got a British passport if I'd wanted. I haven't. Oh, I've got a New Zealand one. But, no, I think what I thought was I wanted to... I felt a bit isolated here. You know, I hadn't even been to Australia by that time. And I suppose I'd been working pretty solidly with doing degrees and stuff. But also, I was aware my mother had developed angina while I was at library school, actually, in the 50s. And I could see that progressively she was doing a bit less all the time. And I thought, if we're going to go to Britain, we'd better go soon. And that's what really made me decide on 1960. I don't know quite why that year was suitable, but it seemed to work anyway, and we did. She turned out to have a very good time because a lot of her old friends were still there. She was in her mid-60s.
So it was a good time.
It was a good time. It was a great time for her. And I got very closely friendly with some of her friends, and you know they became home from home when I went back to Britain after that until her generation, of course, have died long since. But it was a great success, really. So never been sorry that we did it, and she enjoyed it, and she enjoyed travelling. So we would take buses around, and it was quite good. I would have a day or a half off in the middle of the week at Castle Milk, and we closed on Wednesday. Glasgow, a half day that day.
Right, half shut day.
Half shut day. And you could go off to Edinburgh and it would be open, you see. So, you know, we had quite a good time midweek as well as weekends. And we did travel around quite a bit of Scotland. We were right up to Inverness and took bus trips across and train trips and so on. And we had relatives in England, so we saw them, and she had still a lot of friends in Ayrshire. So that were in Kilmarnock and Darvel and New Mills and all those sort of areas. So it really was good. But she had quite a bad heart attack just before we left Scotland. Oh. And I guess she died within a year of us coming back, and her heart had really just worn out, which is, funnily enough, is exactly what happened with my brother. Well, he was a good deal older. He was 20 years older. Well, perhaps not as much as that, but 12 at least. And it must have been a sort of genetic thing, because our brother died of the same sort of thing.
And how did you make the journey to and back then?
We went by sea, of course. I said afterwards we could have flown, but we were a bit doubtful about her health. But she liked sailing. She never got seasick. It was me that got seasick. But we decided to go the other way. We'd come through Panama. So it just happened that we were in a gap when Suez was opened. It had been closed, and it closed again. But we went on the Strathaird from Sydney. So we took a ship from Wellington to Sydney, had a few days there, about 4 or 5 days there, which we enjoyed a lot. And then about 5 weeks to Britain. And it was a very good journey because we stopped at every port around the Australian coast, during which time I was seasick all the way. And then we headed north to Colombo, Bombay, which was my first glimpse of India, and I fell for it. I've been back, I don't know how many times since. And Aden was still a port then. Port side. Then we were just into the Mediterranean when the ship broke down. She was getting onto her last legs. So we had an extra time in Naples, extra time in Marseille. It was like being on a cruise ship.
And it sounds like it.
It was the time of the Rome Olympics. So everybody practically got off at Naples. So we had this empty ship from there on, which was great.
And it's still quite a long time, isn't it? Even 1960.
Yes.
5 weeks.
It was a good 5 weeks, but of course we were doing a lot of ports of call, and you stopped for at least a day in them. And it was three 3 days across the mm-hmm. Tasman, mm-hmm. three very rough days. Because mm-hmm. it was winter, we went off in July, mm-hmm. which was not a good time to travel mm-hmm. around the Australian mm-hmm. coast, really. It was pretty rough. Mm-hmm. But it was a good ship, and it was one of these P&O liners that was built mm-hmm. for the Eastern mm-hmm. trade. So it was right, we headed into the monsoon out of mm-hmm. Bombay, but she just handled it. It was a great ship. Mm-hmm. And I think it was scrapped probably within 2 or 3 years. It was almost the end of the big days of going by sea.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And we mm-hmm. came back through Canada, Empress of England, across the North Atlantic mm-hmm. into the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And mm-hmm. it was a whole day in the St. Lawrence Seaway. It was beautiful. And we took the buses across Canada, stayed with my uncle, and got an Orient liner mm-hmm. down to Vancouver, from Vancouver to Auckland.
That's a proper journey, isn't it?
Yes. So we did this, we've sort of done the round by sea mm-hmm. because that was the last time. It's mm-hmm. been here ever since.
Now, you must have known you'd have lots of time for doing not very much on that yes. journey.
Yes. I slept most of the time.
Well, of course you were sick, weren't you?
Yes, uh-huh. I think even when in the sort of fine weather, but my mother had mm-hmm. a great time. Somebody said to me, didn't you find it a disadvantage being at sea with your mother watching? And I said, oh no, it was me that had to get out of the She had a couple of male followers for the whole journey. I used to vanish off somewhere to let her be. It was good, I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. I feel sad for kids nowadays, mm-hmm. they don't have this fun of the sea voyage. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think going from here to the busyness of London mm-hmm. can be a real shock to the system mm-hmm. because it is just so full of people. Mm-hmm. And here we are, you're sort of in this empty world.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a big difference, isn't it?
It's a huge difference.
Uh-huh. How did you feel when you got off the boat? I mean, you had memories, obviously, of,
yes, that's
of
right.
what it was like, but...
I think I was more anxious of, you know, looking after Mum and having to do mm-hmm. all the things. Mm-hmm. We didn't stop off in London. We went up to stay with relations who were at mm-hmm. Keele University, mm-hmm. so, of course, we were in the country. Mm-hmm. And then for the first bit of being in Scotland, we were living in Hamilton with a friend... Mm-hmm. It wasn't until I went to work in Glasgow, mm. and I don't know, well, I suppose we were suburban a lot of the time, but it wasn't as busy as it is now. Mm. I mean, there wasn't as much traffic, people didn't mm. have the fuel, they didn't have the money, mm. it was lots of people that you knew just didn't have a car. Mm. And you know, those housing schemes were built without mm-hmm. garages. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was just a
huge. That's right. Not enough roads. Yeah.
That's right.
One road in, one road out.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. So it was all quite different from mm-hmm. now. I find the crowds in London absolutely oppressive mm-hmm. now. And to be quite honest, I found Edinburgh oppressive in the middle of the festival.
Yes.
I realised why Lorna always said to me, don't come in festival, mm-hmm. it's too busy. But I wanted to go to the concerts, mm-hmm. you see. And you could hardly move in Princess Street.
I know what you mean, and I sometimes find myself thinking, you are just an old grump, Linda yeah. Fleming, because I get irritated
yes.
by these people yes. that are in my way. Well, they're there on holiday.
That's right, and they're bluffing around. I was so used to having Edinburgh sort of barer than that uh-huh. I just found it.
Uh-huh. It doesn't look right.
Because I wasn't feeling all that well. I couldn't move easily because mm-hmm. of this blooming knee. That I had just tore the ligament.
That was in your last trip.
Yeah, that was this last uh-huh. trip. Uh-huh. And that made it really quite... Because mm-hmm. Edinburgh's a place you want to walk around. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't mm-hmm. able to do it, so it wasn't as good as usual.
Now, how did people behave towards you when you got back to Scotland? You still have quite a good Scottish accent. But,
it was as if that we'd never been away.
Really? So you weren't treated the visiting colonials?
Well, they called me the Kiwi, you see. Yes, uh-huh. In a way, they did think mm-hmm. of me as being... I discovered, though, mm-hmm. That why they were being cautious mm-hmm. when I wrote mm-hmm. and they didn't, you know, they couldn't guarantee me a job. The previous New Zealander who'd been employed by Glasgow Public mm-hmm. Libraries had said she'd stay 6 months mm-hmm. and after 6 weeks she'd earned enough money and just went. Mm-hmm. So they weren't very mm-hmm. enthusiastic. Mm-hmm. I reversed that. Mm-hmm. Instead of staying 6 weeks, I stayed
longer.
Stayed longer. But that was the problem. Mm-hmm. And I had an interview actually with the city librarian, mm-hmm. and they think it was going to take a couple of weeks to get it all through. So Mum and I just went off on a trip. I said, well, we'll come back, you know. So I started work in October and I worked through till about May or June or something like that. And then we had a bit of time in Scotland before we set out for Canada. But I did enjoy it.
Did you take some reading matter along with you? Or did you just count on being able to buy books when you
I think we didn't take much with us. I don't remember. I think we had far more luggage than we needed when I think of it all. We had far too much with us. That's the trouble with going by sea. Going by air concentrates the mind.
It does.
It absolutely concentrates the mind. But we had masses of stuff. You know, maybe two or three big suitcases. And somebody else was moving them all the time. And you could put stuff in the hold and you had stuff in your cabin and no limits set. But I don't remember us taking books, but there were libraries on the boat and we did pick up. You could pick up books when you were getting around. But I certainly had reading stuff with us.
I wondered if you can recall reading anything on that journey back. It's quite a momentous journey, really.
Yeah, I don't remember. I think probably part of the trouble was that for the first 3 weeks of it, I wasn't reading anyway. I wasn't doing anything except taking my mother to the dining room and retiring to the cabin. Just didn't want to look at anything. But I think we picked up some literature when we were in Colombo. There were bookshops there, and I remember picking up paperbacks. I don't remember what they were, no idea. I don't, funnily enough, remember a library on the Strathair, though there probably was. I do remember it on the Oronsay as we came down the Pacific. There was quite a big library. We were borrowing books all the time there. So it probably was on the Strathair. It's just that I don't remember that. But I do remember writing a diary, far fuller diary than I ever wrote again. I always start them and then after the first fortnight forget them. But that's when I wrote a diary all the way through and I kept it up for the whole year I was away. I think it's in the Turnbull Library now, probably.
Where's that?
That's in Wellington. When I was finishing off working.
Well, I'm very glad you've put it somewhere. That's great.
Well, when I was about to leave Melbourne and somebody, the SPAS system in libraries is always pretty good. The Turnbull must have helped, because I was in charge of the National Library and the Turnbull was in there. And they rang me up, I think, and said, what are you doing with your papers, Mary? And I said, well, I was about to sort of clear them out. And they said, yes, right, all. Just put them in a carton and send them all to us. So I had a lot of stuff because I'd been teaching at the school and, of course, you had lecture notes. But I'd done a lot of broadcasting before I left in New Zealand too. So I put that all together. Well, they could have all the diaries too, so I just threw all them in. And then on top of the carton, I put a manila folder to keep them from raining. About, I suppose I sent that off by freight, I don't remember, but about a month later, they rang me again and said, Mary, did you realise that when you sent over this carton of books, there's one of Peter's papers in that manila folder? And I said, is there? I said, what is it? And they said, oh, he's written something about Count von Luckner. And I said, oh, he said, I remember him writing that. And they said, have you got any others? And I said, yes, I've got a stack a mile high. Because he wrote these stuff and he never cared whether they were published or not. Just wrote them because he enjoyed it. Well, we'd like them, please. So I spent the next few months really typing up, because they'd never have been able to read his writing. Hopeless, absolutely hopeless. There was one thing he wrote about the Dalmatian settlers in Auckland. I could not work out what on earth these abbreviations were. And of course, they don't realise that Dalmatia had been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And what he was talking about was the government in Austria. And all these abbreviations had nothing to do with us or Dalmatia. So I did all that and I enjoyed that. That was good. So that stuff is all there too.
Because I'll bet you any money it's in your journals what you read.
I wouldn't be surprised. I don't remember.
Now, how am I going to get my hands on them?
Oh, you just ask at the Turnbull Library. You need to go to Wellington.
I'll have to come back.
You'll have to come back. I don't know whether there's anything there or not. It's hard to say. I couldn't tell you. How funny it is, isn't it? The things that... It takes something to spark the memory often doesn't.
What do you remember about that journey? Well, you said going, taking your mother to the dining room and retiring. Is there anything else you recall about it?
I remember that the captain announced quite early in the game that there would be no organised games that we could play on the deck whenever we liked, but the weather wouldn't be good enough. Mm-hmm. How right he was. But I also remember there was a woman from... I made quite a lot of friends on that journey. Mm-hmm. A lot of very nice people got on in sort of as we went round the Australian coast. And there was one girl who had a small baby who was 5 months old. I remember the baby's name was Kim. I don't remember mother's name. But she was going home to take Kim to see grandparents in Yorkshire. So Kim and I spent many afternoons asleep together on a deck chair. I was babysitting, and mother went off to play games. But it was a good voyage. They had very good entertainment, musical, and you know, sort of games and parties and so on. And there were two swimming pools. There was one up forward, there was one fairly near us. Two dining rooms. It was a one-class ship on the way to Britain and a two-class ship coming out.
Now, isn't that interesting?
Isn't it? Isn't it? But it was so we had the whole run of the whole ship, and we were in the forward dining room, which I think was probably the first-class one. And I can remember sitting in the top lounge once when we had a storm and somebody sitting on a couch suddenly migrated from one side of the thing to the other. As a thing. But my mother got on very well with the vice captain, who was the sort of entertainment captain, and we got very nice extra privileges down on the deck. You didn't have to go to the bar to get a nice orange juice or something. It was duly delivered to you by these attendant stewards that she somehow managed to get.
How posh.
It was really quite posh. It was good.
And you've said that you liked it back in Scotland.
Oh, I loved it.
You would
it.
Have liked to
Oh, I loved
stay.
It. Yes, I did. Mm. Yes. I've often wondered, I think I probably wouldn't have stayed because I had got leave from here without pay, and that was what Mr. Dunningham had got when he decided not to return. So there was a... I just felt if I don't go back, nobody else will ever get leave again. And as it happened, the day after I left Dunedin to go on leave, I was appointed deputy city librarian, and it did seem a bit stupid not to come back. It took me a little while to settle back, I must say, but not really all that much, and there was still much to do in the library, and it was a new job, and it was all interesting. I settled down and probably would never have been able to get the interesting work in Britain that I got here, because the interesting jobs in Glasgow public libraries were still male.
Yes, you've said that. I find that quite interesting, but not surprising.
It was the Mitchell was a male preserve.
So do you think that kind of gender difference was less marked here?
It was less marked here, but it was still there, because people like Geoffrey Alley, who was the national librarian, was national librarian for a long time, absolutely assumed that the training of librarians had to be male. There had to be a sufficient number of males to occupy the senior positions. I mean, that was what he thought and that's what he said. It's not what's happened, of course, but he rather condescendingly said, oh, girls just come to work until they marry. Well, for a while it had to be, because if they married they were thrown out. But, of course, that ceased after the war. That didn't. That wasn't the case. But I can remember once having an argument with Geoffrey Alley about this and saying, well, if you analysed what your male staff have done, do they sit still in your library forever? No, of course they don't. They move on to a promotion somewhere else. So you might as well have a woman going off to be married as a man who goes off to be something else. But that was true then. And I would think that, well, I know when I went to the National Library, I was the first female who was ever in the executive class of the whole government service. You know, it was still a man's domain at the top.
Now, you got those promotions then in the 60s.
I was deputy librarian here in 1960 when I left. I became city librarian in 1968. And I went to be national librarian in 1976. And then Peter and I were married in 1981, And I went to Auckland then and was an Auckland City librarian for 3 years there. And that had been a male-dominated society, more than here. In Dunedin, the city council people, the in-charge people like the town clerk, he made no difference at all between male and female. If you wanted to go into an Institute of Public Administration or business management stuff, you got encouraged to go. But it was still rather masculine oriented in Auckland.
Now, why do you think that is? Can you account for that difference?
I can't account for it because the assumption has always been that Dunedin is more conservative than all the rest of them. And I'm inclined to think that that's a piece of nonsense, absolute nonsense. That here was this acceptance here that women were in charge of things. Perhaps it was the fact that women had been in charge of a major high school or several major high schools by that time. And I don't know. But or it may simply have been the individuals who happened to be around. And often that's what it is. It's not a general thing at all. I in Wellington, I was all of my chief people were male. But they didn't make any bones about it. It was the other staff who obviously were surprised if you were coming into a cabinet meeting and you were a female. Because I used to take my CEO over, and in those days your CEO wasn't the chap at the top, he was in charge of usually your office staff. And I can remember the first time I went to a cabinet committee meeting, and the cabinet secretary came up and said to Jim Hall, "Oh, you're the new national librarian." And Jim was very embarrassed and said, no, this is the national librarian. And a complete look of utter shock. So I just said, "You'll get used to it." And after that, it wasn't so bad. But I don't think there was a single woman in that cabinet. I'm sure there wasn't. It was entirely male. You wouldn't find that now. Well, that was the mid-70s. I had a very good minister. He was great. Couldn't have asked for better. But I think he was the one that said, "You realise that you're the first woman that's managed to get onto the executive class in the public service." Well, that was, that was pretty slow, given the fact that there were women lawyers in departments and things like that, and they'd never really been recognised, because it was still functioning as if it were clerical. And all those pay scales and their gradings and everything else reflected a great clerical mass. And it didn't make allowance for the fact that there were a whole lot of specialists in the public service by that time. I think that's obvious now. All the pay arrangements are different anyway. Half of them are on contract. And it's not salary anymore. You negotiate your price.
So really, and you had time in Australia too during that time.
I went to Australia after Auckland, and I was there really in the 90s. Well, I went over there in 1987, and I worked, I suppose, for 5 years until I was 65, and then had another couple of years after that before I decided to come back. And that time, Peter died during that time, and my sister-in-law had died here, so I decided it made sense to come back to Dunedin, so I did.
You've been in a few places then, and that must have kind of affected what you like to read. When you started off your reading career, if you like, with very British sensibility. How has that changed?
I think one of the things I got conscious of when I went to Australia was just how little I knew about Australian literature, because it just didn't... I mean, you had obvious people that came across, but there weren't very many of them, and I got sort of interested in that. So that made a huge difference. But one of the things I did notice was the difference in libraries over there. I lived in Mount Waverley, which had a population of roughly the same as Dunedin at that time, which was 110,000. And it had nothing that even faintly looked like a central library. Nothing. It had a series of little libraries that were little branch libraries.
Which state is that in?
Victoria.
Victoria, yeah. Of course, yes.
And there was nothing that was an in-depth library. If I hadn't had the university library, I would have had nothing to read, because you couldn't follow any subject through. Lots of interesting popular stuff, the latest sort of popular stuff. But I'd been used to this concept mm-hmm. of the British sort of concept mm-hmm. of the central library. Mm-hmm. And it really didn't exist. And I decided it was because of the state libraries. Mm-hmm. They were the great public mm-hmm. libraries. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was 20 minutes, well, it was 20 kilometres to the state library from where I lived, mm-hmm. and for lots of people it would be much more. And you couldn't borrow from the state library. It was a reference library. So there was no sense of being able to follow a topic mm. through mm-hmm. if you didn't have access to... I mean, Monash mm-hmm. University Library mm-hmm. was very good indeed, and it was not a problem. But for the general public, mm-hmm. there would be nothing like the expectation mm-hmm. that they would have mm-hmm. of us here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you noticed all these sort of mm-hmm. differences. Mm-hmm. I tried to think where I used to get my books when I was in the National Library. I certainly didn't borrow National Library books because we didn't lend mm-hmm. them. I must have gone to the public library and bought and mm-hmm. looked there. Yeah.
What were you reading then? Tell me, in the 70s, can you remember?
In the 70s, I don't know mm-hmm. if I can remember particularly. But I certainly read a lot because I had made up my mind that I wasn't doing this business of taking a satchel of papers home at night, mm-hmm. that if I couldn't manage mm-hmm. my work during mm-hmm. the day, there was something mm-hmm. wrong with me. So that, in fact, I was reading. And it's very hard to remember, you know, what I would be reading at that stage. But I think probably I was reading quite a bit of New Zealand stuff because for about 2 or 3 years I was on the Watty Awards judging things. And, of course, that meant you were reading, you know, great wads of stuff. But even before that, I think I'd got much more into reading. There were far more New Zealand novelists coming up, of mm-hmm. course. Mm-hmm. Janet Frayn was at the sort of height of her powers, but there were other people, and I got to know people like Vincent O'Sullivan, who's mm-hmm. was at Victoria and who was a friend of Peter's. Mm-hmm. And of course, Peter was bringing books home, and he had a different range of interests. He of course, was crazy about Evelyn Waugh and Graham Greene mm-hmm. and so on. So I read probably more of those. Mm-hmm. But I do think the biggest change there was I began to read a lot more New Zealand literature because mm-hmm. there was much more of it coming out. Mm-hmm. But not so much local history, because this was the place where local history seemed to mm-hmm. flourish. Mm-hmm. It's flourishing elsewhere more now, but mm-hmm. Otago's always been a great writer up of itself.
What were those awards that you mentioned?
Oh, it was, still exists. There's mm-hmm. a book award every year. Mm-hmm. Now, Watty's no longer funded. Mm-hmm. I've forgotten what it's called now. Mm-hmm. But they, in those days, you were candid a mass of New Zealand literature, which mm-hmm. the publishers had mm-hmm. put in as possible candidates. And you had to make judgments on, I think, a third was book production, mm-hmm. a third was subject matter, a third was style, that sort of division. And fiction and poetry and natural history and mm-hmm. history were all mixed up together. It was, that, you know, not an easy sort of job mm-hmm. to do, but you were reading a whole mass of stuff mm-hmm. all across the board. And I must have done that once in Wellington and then certainly in Auckland. Mm-hmm. And it was at that stage that Janet Frame had written her first of her autobiographies, To the Island. Mm-hmm. And it was quite interesting. I didn't know the other two members of the committee up there. And one was Warwick Roger, mm-hmm. who edited a magazine called mm-hmm. Metro, mm-hmm. and he's still about doing that. And the other, not going to remember his name, but he was a publisher. Mm-hmm. And it was quite clear when they came into my office that they had made up their mind who mm-hmm. was going to win this. And it was equally clear that they didn't think I'd understand. And they said, "We think we've made up our minds, Mary." And I said, "Well, so have I. Should we write them down on a piece of paper?" Mm-hmm. And it was all the same. And it was Janet Frames.
Yeah, right.
And there was no doubt about it. Uh-huh. I mean,
what do you feel about her writing?
Mixed. I think mm-hmm. some of her novels are marvellous, absolutely mm-hmm. marvellous, and others are almost impenetrable.
Yes. They're not very accessible, are they?
Not mm-hmm. at all. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, she was a very withdrawn person. Mm-hmm. She came to live in Dunedin in the mm-hmm. end. She came from this area. She mm-hmm. was born in Oamaru. But she melted a bit after that, and then Michael King, mm-hmm. whose work I've read all through mm-hmm. for a long time, Michael did her biography, mm-hmm. and he was always a very reasonable mm-hmm. person, and mm-hmm. he made it clear to her that he would not be making judgments about things that she didn't want revealed.
Mm.
If she didn't want them revealed, he would respect that. Mm. And he did. He really did. And I think that he did a huge amount to bring her out of her shell. She died of cancer. And then Michael, after the success of the book, his publishers gave him a weekend with his wife in a posh resort.
Mm.
And while driving to it, he drove into a tree and the whole thing exploded, and that was the end of him. Always, it just seems so unfair.
Mm.
He was a great bloke, and he's written some interesting history. The other thing, of course, I was probably also reading New Zealand history, because that's what Peter was into. You see, he taught history at Auckland University. Mm-hmm. So Keith Sinclair and Bill Oliver and all these historians were part of the drifting around of the people that I met. Alistair Campbell, who's a poet, I'd known him vaguely when he was here, but I got to know him better. So there was a whole new range of people that came in.
Was that reading of New Zealand fiction then at the expense of other authors that you'd been fond of earlier?
I'm not consciously. I think you just sort of move from one to the other. And sometimes you just read a bit more. I don't remember consciously not reading things that I'd been used to, you know, say Margie Allingham, I published a new one, she's probably was finished by that time, but you know, that kind of thing. And it was somebody like Eric Newby, I think I discovered while I was up there. So, you know, I've got everything practically that he's written in the episode. He's so funny.
Do you bring books back from Scotland when you come back?
Yes, I do. Yes.
Do you get into trouble at the airport?
But quite often I post things back.
Uh-huh.
But I can still remember, it must have been the early 70s, I must have read A Short Walk in the Hindu Kush by Eric Newby. And I thought it was one of the funniest. And at that year I decided to come back via Tashkent, Samarkand, Bukhara, and that was one of the other funniest stories. I was city librarian by then, and I must have been going to an IFLA meeting. And anyway, the Russian embassy gave us a present of Russian novels, and they sent two of their Russian people down to the library to present them. So I gave them afternoon tea and chatted away with the cultural ambassador, and the other man sat. Absolutely wouldn't lend and say anything. So I thought, I've got to get about this. So I said, what do you do in the embassy? And the minute I asked him, I thought, it isn't the sort of thing you should ask a Russian. And he said, I am the travel man. So I said, great, because I want to go to Bukhara and Samarkand. Right, he said, reached into his inside pocket and produced an air timetable that told me just that, nothing else. I felt as though my office had been bugged. So I eventually went that way and sort of came back. Well, as I flew out of Tashkent to go to Delhi, we were going Tashkent to Kabul, Afghanistan is still okay, down to Delhi. And there were a bunch of German students all round me in the plane. And one of them said to me, do you know what those mountains are? And I said, they're the Hindu Kush, nearly in tears, because here I was on top of the Hindu Kush. Well, they were just about as excited, so we swapped seats all the way across. The whole lot of us managed to see the Hindu Kush, because I felt this was just extra special.
So travel writing then, obviously, something you really engaged.
Yeah, and I read a lot about India. I'd gone to... glimpsed India with Mum in Bombay, and we both liked it hugely. And then I went back in 71 when I was heading for Britain and had a week in Delhi and then a week up in Kathmandu. And that year I went to the International Federation of Library Associations meeting in Liverpool and I met up with Jaggi Mehta, who later became the director of public libraries in Delhi. So every time I've been to India, of course, I've seen Jaggi. So I've been to India a lot because he and Vimal, his wife, became very dear friends. So I did see Jaggi as I came back this year, and Vimal died 2 weeks before I got there. So it was really quite sad, and Jaggi's looking very fragile and had just had his 91st birthday. But that was part of my attachment to India. And Jaggi finally enchanted me by saying that he thought that we must have met in a previous incarnation. But I did read a lot of stuff, and I'd always, when I look back, I'd always read a lot about India.
And what about all the post-colonial literature that, yes. that's come out in the last 20 years or so. What do you think about that?
And some of it's absolutely fascinating. Mm. You know, Suitable Boy, for instance. Okay. And I was absolutely fascinated because I was invited to Jackie's granddaughter's wedding. I couldn't go. But in the course of Jackie's letter to me, and he said it was an arranged marriage because she'd asked for this, and we, what did he say? We took some time to find a suitable boy. And he used this phrase. Exactly. So when I was over there last year, they showed me all the films. I was really quite glad I hadn't gone. I couldn't have kept up that sartorial elegance at all. All these women in beautiful clothes, but the men in beautiful clothes too.
Now, I saw in the local paper here, actually, there was a Hindu wedding in Dunedin, the first one ever.
First one, that's right. Well, this is the sort of wedding that Sonal had, but it was in Bombay, because that's where the groom's family came from. And this was all arranged. I imagine that they're all the same level of business deals and so on, because Sonal's father is in construction. And I don't think he's got bricks in his hand.
That article I was talking about was in the Otago
Daily Times,
which I see you had a copy of.
Yes.
So that's your daily newspaper.
That's my daily newspaper, yes. Yeah, it's the only one now. There used to be two. There was an evening paper, the Evening Star, the Otago Daily Times. But like so many evening papers, it's just gone. And it publishes a freebie. About once a week, with local, a lot of local stuff in it.
The Otago Daily Times, just to get a bit of perspective, you know, without being too colonialist about it, it's a kind of Glasgow Herald, really.
Yes, it is. And it's got more so. They had an editor who was extremely good and brought a lot of international stuff into it. Well, we get a supplement on Mondays with international news on. He instituted that, but the general standard of the paper was much more, you got more news from around New Zealand. The chap who they appointed as editor had been the editor of all the, they run a whole lot of little newspapers around the province, this company, and that's what he's brought. So it's now turned into a very localised paper.
Yes, I know it is quite local.
Very local, and I think a lot of people, there's a lot of people in Dunedin by the press, which is available on almost all over the town, which is the Christchurch paper. And I noticed down in Queenstown, the New Zealand Herald was there. That's the Auckland one.
There's quite an array of newspapers though here.
But most of them are, this is the only one, the Otago Daily Times is the only one that's not internationally owned. It is a family firm, and its owner lives next door in that posh house in the to the hedge.
Well, you are in a select neighbourhood.
I think it's one of Dunedin's few millionaires. Except that the owner of this house is clearly a millionaire. But, you know, he's not local. I don't know what he is. But he's interesting too. He's a book collector. And he collects books from the 17th century England. And I once said to him something about the light, you know, I have a good light to be able to see things. And he said, that's not what books are for, Mary. They're for sitting in the dark, feeling them. That's not my way of books. But that's his. So he does printing, though. There's a printing press down in the summer house down there. So.
Good heavens.
So very fascinating.
So what about Sunday paper, then? What do you do for that?
I don't do anything, but lots of people do. There's the Sunday, there are two Sunday papers, and I think they both come out of Auckland. But there's one that's much better than the other. The one's a bit of a gossip rag. Don't ask me which is which, because I don't know. I don't get them.
Right.
Partly because I want to read other things. The trouble is, I'm addicted to things like Sudoku and crosswords and things. And I sometimes think I read the Italian Daily Times for the puzzles page, rather than anything else.
Well, that's fair enough.
Well, why not?
And you're still using the library.
Oh, yes, all the time. Oh, yes. Pile of books over there.
Is there a library more local to you here, or do you have
the
to go
mobile
into the
library
central
comes
one?
In down just below the bus stops. But in fact, I go into town because it's about 10 minutes in the bus. I don't think that they will ever build a library out here, but what's badly needed mm-hmm. is a library over in South Dunedin, which is just uh-huh. sort of straight through there. Uh-huh. Very thick population, mm-hmm. quite poor population, mm-hmm. older, mm-hmm. which needs one, and they've been trying to get money for mm-hmm. this, and rather hoping that the stadium would go fly a kite, but the stadium has
this
not.
This is the new stadium that's proposed for well, Dunedin, yes, the
been
sports stadium.
Dickering around, they've mm-hmm. spent 35 mm-hmm. million doing preparations for it. Mm-hmm. And as somebody said, that could have built the South Dunedin mm-hmm. Library.
It's very controversial, isn't it?
Very, mm-hmm. very. And they're clearly, mm-hmm. it's sort of provisional even now, mm-hmm. but they're not willing to give it up. Mm-hmm. Yes. I've always felt they're wasting their time fighting mm-hmm. it.
It doesn't seem to be very popular anyway.
No, it's not.
You said earlier on you still do feel Scottish.
Yes. Yes.
Do you feel New Zealand as well?
Yes, I do.
Or a New Zealander?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. The only time I'm utterly certain that I'm Scottish is mm-hmm. when the All Blacks are playing Scotland. I know who's going to win, but I keep hoping that they won't.
Now, that's the real acid test, isn't it?
Isn't it? Absolutely acid test. Uh-huh. And you know that the chances of Scotland beating the All Blacks is just about zero.
Not high, no.
But I don't care. I wouldn't mind if they beat the All Blacks.
Do you still read Scottish newspapers, Mary, ever at all?
No, I don't. I read them when I'm at home, when I'm mm-hmm. in Scotland. Mm-hmm. But
do they still carry them in the library here?
Do you know, I don't even know the answer to that. Mm. They used to, and the fact they carried several, mm-hmm. but it's quite possible what they do. Mm-hmm. I just don't know the answer. Mm-hmm. For a long time after we came, my mother read them, and I suppose I did too, but it wears off. Mm. You stop doing it, mm-hmm. and you read books about Scotland, and you read mm-hmm. articles, mm-hmm. and the Scots magazine, mm-hmm. Particularly it, because it's a good little magazine. Mm-hmm. There's another Scottish magazine, Scottish Field.
Yes, uh-huh.
Lots of people uh-huh. here get Scottish Field. Uh-huh. And you're more likely to read that than the newspapers after a while. Mm-hmm. I know we stopped, I think Mum stopped even after perhaps 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. She did read them all through the war because she was sort of concerned about people and what was happening.
It's what do you think about the sort of Scottish organisations then, the Burns Clubs and the Caledonian Society.
Well, we never joined. We never joined.
Do you think they're a good thing or?
Well, they're fading away. Mm. Even the Gaelic Society, which really dealt seriously with the language and the music, that's gone. The Burns Club, I would think that the average age is probably 75. Mm. Even Scottish Country Dancing, which we did do because we wanted the dancing and the music, has diminished. The club I went to last night, there were 30 people there and thoroughly enjoying themselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, they really do, they enjoy it. And we've suddenly got the Professor of Music from the University of Otago has joined. Mm-hmm. And, you know.
My goodness.
Yes, and his wife comes. Uh-huh. So, you know, that's. And that started because the Hocken Library had its centennial and they wanted a ball at Larner Castle. Mm-hmm. And they said, what do you think of that, Mary? And I said, I'm not coming unless there's some Scottish country dancing. Now, one of the girls at Megan and the Hocken staff, her mother teaches Scottish country dancing. So Janet went down and taught them and ate some reel and a gay Gordons and a bit of that. So we did it up at Larner Castle. Mm-hmm. There was no space, but we did it and we enjoyed ourselves. And we've probably got about 6 or 8 people that have come since then because they enjoyed it too. And Janet's a very good teacher. She's a New Zealander, but she's great.
Now that's interesting, a New Zealander teaching the Scots
how
to do the Scottish country dancing.
A lot of the people that come to summer schools come here from Japan. And the biggest growing place for Scottish country dancing these days is Japan. And they are taught by Japanese. And they were in St Andrews. I think the class I was in St Andrews, which I must say I had to go out of after a day, I doubt if there were more than a third of them Scots. There were French, Japanese, and the pianist was Japanese.
Extraordinary. It's an export industry then.
It's an export industry.
Rather than a domestic one, I think so. Because
well, exactly.
It's probably not as popular.
No. It's the same thing's happening in Scotland as here. It's the Ceilidh dancing in Scotland that's
right.
I think the RACDS is probably too full of rules.
You've been very, very good. You've spoken for a long time, and I know that's tiring. So could I just ask you some very tightly knit questions about particular authors that have a Scottish spin on them?
Right.
And then I'll ask you one final question and we'll call it a day. Now, have you ever read any of the following? The poetry of Robert Burns.
I could recite some to you if you like.
Go ahead.
When Chapman Billy's leave the street, and Ruthie neighbours meet, we sit boozing at the nappy and getting food and Uncle Happy. Yes, lots of Burns. Uh-huh. Yes.
And are you still reading that?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. In fact, I go back every now and then. And, you know, after Liam had done his recitation, I went back and reread it because I enjoyed it so much.
Mm-hmm. But this was at the opening of Burns exhibition.
Yes, uh-huh. I do think it improves with reading out loud.
Yes, oh yes, you have to hear it really.
You have to hear it because unprinted doesn't look so good.
Do you think that is especially so if you're far away? Do you think the distance makes any difference? No,
I don't think so. I think that's true about all poetry. Mm-hmm. I can remember, you know, we've got a very good Whitman collection in that library, and I couldn't think why anybody read it. And then we had an American who came to the department, and he did a session on Whitman, and suddenly he heard it. Mm-hmm. And it was a different thing.
Now, a question I never asked you, I'll just sneak it in here, was whether or not you ever listened to the World Service, the BBC.
No. No, if you want to listen to the BBC here, it's 2 a.m. Never enthusiastic enough. A lot of people do, though.
That time difference is...
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some of the best programmes that appear on television started about 1 or 12. Mm-hmm. And I'm not an enthusiastic television watcher anyway. Mm.
But so you don't watch Coronation Street?
No, I'm afraid I don't. I cannot take Coronation Street. And when I was in Australia, I couldn't watch EastEnders either. Mm-hmm. But Peter did. Mm-hmm. Don't think you watched Coronation Street, but he certainly watched the EastEnders. Mm-hmm. Probably watched more television then, because he was a television addict.
Well, I used to watch Neighbours.
Oh, I've never
When my children were small.
Well, that's something I've never watched either. Mm-hmm. I'm not good at watching. Mm-hmm. We've got a ship coming.
Me neither, I'm not a big... Anyway, the next one's Walter Scott, and I'll be interested to know what you think about
him. I think I've probably read most of them. Mm-hmm. I loved... When I was a kid, I loved Ivanhoe and I think the sort of adventure ones, you know, the historical ones. Mm-hmm. But I've read a lot of them, read Gauntlet, just anything that came around, and I've got most of them there.
Did you like them?
Yes, I did. But I always skipped the introduction. I became expert at skipping.
He's a bit long-winded.
Very long-winded. And even Mr. McEwen, you know, who's the first librarian, he kept, you know, he always made sure he had the best editions of all the bits. He said, Walter Scott rather sits on the shelf. But you see, in this stuff I've been cataloguing up at Queenstown, complete set of the Waverley novels. Mm-hmm. And warm. Mm-hmm. Not sitting fresh, untouched, every single one of them.
They've been read and read.
Uh-huh. Peveril of the Peak, all of those ones, not even the most obvious ones. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. They did have their vogue. Mm-hmm. But I enjoyed them, but I didn't learn to skim the wordiness of lots of them. Mm-hmm.
Now, when would they have been read at that library you're cataloguing in?
I would think any time between 1870 and when it disbanded, and probably nobody much was up in that area, certainly after the 1920s. Mm-hmm. I don't know when Upper Shotover Library faded. Mm-hmm. I can't even find out for sure where it was, but it would be later than the first of the gold rushes, which were 1860s, so I think they were importing that stuff. Late 60s through the 70s into the 80s, and it stuck around in most libraries until the 20s and 30s when they began to get, well, either the disbanded, that one was just shut up in a place and it's just in banana boxes now. But that would be the period, probably. But some of them look as though they've never been opened, but the not one of the Walter Scotts. And there were some Stevenson, there were Robert Louis Stevenson titles I'd never heard of, and I've got a lot of Stevenson.
Well, my next one is Robert Louis Stevenson, and specifically A Child's Garden of Verses. But I already know that's a great love of yours.
Addicted to that. But then his Island Nights Entertainment, and I went to Samoa to go in search of Robert Louis Stevenson.
Wow. Easier for you to do that, mind
you. Well, that's
you.
True. Judith and I found this deal that Air New Zealand was running, and we could go up to Samoa and have a week in Aggie Gray's hotel, which is the great traditional trader's hotel, for $1,000 there and back, and 5 days. So we had a great week.
And did you do much sort of Stevenson heritage?
Well, we went right up to the place. The thing that upset me when we were up there, they took us around and they kept calling him Robert. So I said, look, sorry, but he was never called Robert. I think you should stop calling him Robert. Well, that's his Christian name. And I said, was not ever called Robert. But they weren't listening.
No.
But we did go right through the place.
They ought to have.
But he was, it was fascinating. I mean, he got involved with local politics and all sorts of things. Yes, I've read a lot about him, and I like it. I think his stuff is lovely. Not just the popular ones, but his prose is beautiful.
And would you say Stevenson was as popular amongst New Zealanders as well?
No. Though the stuff was there. You see, there was Stevenson stuff up there. Just let you glimpse my collection of stuff through there. But he's not as obvious. Well, of course, that stuff that I was seeing must have been very early, because he wasn't really writing as early as the 1860s, 70s. So that, you know, it was a bit early for him. But he was certainly somebody that I got interested in after the period of reading things like Treasure Island and the exciting ones. Right.
So you brought that with you, really?
Yes.
From Scotland.
Yes, and I've bought a lot since, you know, often from second-hand bookshops, just picked up the Stevenson stuff. Well, you really find it more enjoyable to read than Scott, of course, because he's not so... He's smoother.
And those books you've picked up in second-hand shops, has that been here?
Yes. Yes, that's mostly here. Because the stuff I pick up when I'm away, I tend to pass on to somebody else. It's often new stuff, you know. I might be going through one of the bookshops and pick up something and read it and drop it in on my next stop and pick up from there, which is what we do a lot of.
So you're sending books on a journey.
Yes. Travelling around, yes.
The next one is Lewis Grassic Gibbon. That's coming into the 20th century.
Oh, that's right. I remember reading them when I was working in the library. I haven't for a long time. And funnily enough, the University of the Third Age, which is a great institution here, they did a series which, unfortunately, I couldn't get into. They were all overspring. But on his area and that whole period. And somebody said to me, have you ever heard of Lewis Grassic Gibbon? And I said, well, you used to have a very good collection in the library, and I read them then, and they had never heard of him, but he's definitely been taught here, and this was to the age group. There must have been somebody in the English department that specialised, but they said it was absolutely marvellous. Everybody loved it. That would be about 4 or 5 years ago. So he's been introduced to here, and I think a lot of people went into the library and borrowed the books afterwards.
And so when did you come in contact?
Oh, I would think probably in the 50s, 60s,
quite early,
a long time ago. Perhaps even when I was doing English at the university, which would have been in the late 40s. But it's certainly quite a long time ago. Yes.
Neil Munro.
Oh, yes, I read most of what I could see of Neil Munro. He did come out of the library.
You're reading that upside down.
Yes, I can read it upside down, yes.
Well, we've skipped John Buchan because you
yes, I've told you about John Buchan, yes.
And the next one, going into sort of really popular stuff, is A.J. Cronin.
I didn't like him, but that was one of the things my mother read. She read all the Cronin stuff, but I wasn't keen on him. I'm not sure why, but he just wasn't my cup of tea.
I read them because they were there in the library shelf.
Yes.
And I did quite enjoy them, actually, but yes, a lot of them were about English towns and whatnot.
Yes.
So maybe not. Maybe you didn't
connect. Yeah, well, I can remember. I used to bring them home for Mum, but I just I don't think I ever read them myself. Mm-hmm. But she enjoyed them.
Even though he is a Scottish author,
yes,
you know.
Yes,
yes. Neil Gunn.
Yeah, I read some of him, but that's a long time ago now, too. Mm-hmm. Probably 30 years since I read Neil Gunn.
But did you read that here, Mary?
Yes. Oh, yes, it would be here. Right. Yes.
Muriel Spark?
Oh, I love it. Yes.
I'm so pleased you said that.
Every
she's
single
my
thing
favourite.
She's, I think a lot of them are up there. Everything she's ever read. I always had to get on with her. I think she's great. Yes. She's
good.
She's one of my favourites of them all.
I'm always a wee bit dispirited when I ask people about Muriel Spark, and they say, oh, I can't be bothered with that.
Oh, no, I think she's just terrific. Yes, yes.
Sheena Mackay.
Don't know.
Don't know that one.
No.
Well, there's a name for you to conjure with. No. And a similar one is Kate Atkinson.
I've encountered Kate Atkinson, yes. In fact, I think I might have one of her books home at the moment. Yes. But they're new. They're writing now.
She's writing now.
Right.
The very popular authors, some of them you've mentioned, like Ian Rankin.
Yes.
There's another Scottish, our books are not based in Scotland, well, not usually, called Val McDermott, who writes detective and thrillers.
No.
Quite gory ones, actually.
But they all are these days. You know, they dissect everybody.
How do you feel about that, the sort of ghastly gruesomeness?
I think it's put me off.
Modern thriller writing.
There are various people that I used to read and I suddenly found that I didn't want to. Patricia Cornwell was a sort of example. And I suddenly thought, I don't really want to read about all that anymore. The sort of violence that's... What did I retreat into? I read something. He's an Englishman who writes and wrote in France, and he obviously lived in France. What was his name? And they dug some of them up in the basement in the library and put them out. And I read one and I thought, isn't that a rest? Because it wasn't full of violence. I mean, the murders were there, but they were off stage, as it were. And you didn't have this sense of meaningless violence that I think can be so awful in some modern ones. And that does put me off.
Margaret Thompson Davis.
No, I don't know Margaret Thompson Davis.
These are kind of historical novels.
Oh, right.
Usually set in Glasgow, I think. They're very popular.
The person I hadn't read was, what's her name? She writes about Clyde Bank. Finding Peggy.
Oh, Meg Henderson.
Meg Henderson. Yes. I've got everything she's written.
You like those?
Yes, I do. Yes.
I've only read Finding Peggy. I haven't read any.
Well, there was one about the bombing of Clyde Bank. That wasn't Finding Peggy, was it? Maybe it was. But the damage and the disappearance of people that we'd never heard about. It's just incredible. And there's... Was it The Last Voyage? It was one about a fishing trawler. That's wonderful. That was great. I've handed my copy to everybody I can find.
Are they really quite Scottish, those books?
Yes. Yes, I think she's great.
Well, there you go. George MacDonald Fraser, the last.
The General danced at
dawn.
Well, I think that was one of the funniest books. The people that gave me that was... After a Scottish Country Dance School here in Dunedin, which I'd organised, and a whole mass of Australians came, and they came to visit me. I'd lived in the middle of the city at the time, and they brought me George MacDonald Fraser as a present. And I don't think I've ever laughed as much at any single novel.
I mean, I do quite like the Flashman books. I know they're sort of boys' own stories.
Yes, but they're still very funny, aren't they? Yes.
They are funny.
Yes.
He died last year.
Did he? I think I noticed that he had died. I think he got a notice in the papers here.
Did he?
Yes. I think it must have been here that I read it. Yes, I'm sure it was after I came back.
Now, you've mentioned most of the publications that I've got listed here. But some of the sort of more popular ones, if you know what I mean. Right. Things like the Sunday Post.
No.
Now, I wondered if the Sunday Post made it over to Dunedin.
Don't remember ever seeing it. No. It would certainly never have been in the library. Mm-hmm. And not that
no, I mean, it's a very popular paper. It's a,
no, I don't think so. I don't remember ever seeing it here.
It carries the comic strips, you know, the Oor Willy.
Oh, Oor Willy. You can buy Oor Willy in the Scottish shop in Dunedin.
Yes, I've seen it.
Why not, you might. Actually, that shop is really... It's got some very good records. I've just picked up Gene Redpath, Robert Burns.
I noticed that had a lot of music in it.
Yes. Well, there's, I've got managed to get two out of the three, and she's going to get the other one for me. I've not really bought records for quite a while because I've got too many, but I suddenly saw these Gene Redpath, and they're lovely. And they're really very nice, those people in there. They're very willing to do anything for you. And I think they do very well at the cruise ships, too.
They probably do.
Yes, yes.
The famous Irish tenor has not come back to me yet.
John McCormick.
There you go. Seeing you.
Just came up.
Now, I've made you happy now.
Yes, there you are. It's John McCormick. Yes, that was one of my father's. But Peter loved him. He thought Peter was a very true ear, and he reckoned he was one of the great tenors. So that, it's not all that long ago, it's not just my childhood, George McCormick. In fact, I've probably sung stuff in there.
Right, one last question. This is a hard one, though.
Oh, is it?
Could you, and given all your experience, sum up for me what books have meant to you?
Oh, I would think that they've just been absolutely fundamental. I just can't imagine. I just can't imagine life without them. Fundamental's the word, I would think. And after we came to New Zealand, I suspect that they were very fundamental indeed, that if I hadn't had them, I might have been really very miserable. And I think we probably were all like that, the three of us, my mother too. But Jim and I just had our noses in books all the time. I was probably a bit more passionate even than Jim. He sort of grew away from it a bit, but he still read widely. But I just cannot imagine. I can remember being in Russia, having taken a book with me, and of course you had to be very wary about what you took into Russia at the time, and I finished it, and I suddenly discovered that there I was with nothing to read. That was terrible, even in a place where there were all sorts of things to see. I wanted something to read. And all that there was this terrible Russian propaganda in English. Wasn't good enough. Would you like to come and see my... If you're finished...
I would. I think we'll call it a day there, right. Because you've been marvellous. Can I thank you very, very much indeed?
It's been a pleasure, Linda.
It's been an absolute pleasure for me.
I really enjoyed it.